Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, August 26, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniz is still doing election stuff. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on this show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Health-wise, again, I'm doing okay. I think the Lyme, I have a little bit of a concern because I'm going to finish my antibiotics very soon. And when they're finished, the thing that antibiotics do for you is they lop the top of the head off the monster. So what they do is they kill active forms of Lyme disease. And the other thing they can do is drive spirochetes into persister forms. So into your L form, your stationary phase, or into your encysted phase. So I'm concerned that by taking 2 months of antibiotics, that I might have some persister forms in my body, and that once I stop taking the antibiotics, they're going to come out of hiding. Meanwhile, of course, I'm still going to take herbs. Once I stop the antibiotics, I'm not going to stop taking Buner herbs, and I may be able to increase the Buner herbs and tolerate them better because I won't be on the antibiotic. But I'm having small doses of Cryptolepis, Hotunia, and Kudzu, plus I'm taking Cordyceps and Motherwort, and some detox stuff. I'm taking chlorella and spirulina and milk thistle, and a lot of antioxidants. So it's quite possible that everything I'm doing together is improving my health. One of the big things that I'm noticing is that I have more energy overall. I do get tired at the end of the day, but it's a normal tired. I'm having less episodes of crushing fatigue, which is very exciting. If you have stealth microbes, it's worth treating them. And if you're not sure if you have stealth microbes, you can take up with a natural medicine practitioner of some kind, and they can help you detect if you have certain stealth microbes and just give you ideas on how to avoid system disruptors. And system disruptors is the big term that Bill Rawls uses in his books. So system disruptors are going to be things like stress, eating processed food, eating food intolerances, not resting, not getting exercise. And on the other hand, if you do basic lifestyle things, you're going to feel a lot better. So getting adequate sleep, energy pacing, and all that stuff. The big thing that I had is these energy crashes, and the energy crashes are just not as bad, which is very exciting. I am still concerned about my spinal stenosis, the pain and weakness in my legs goes up and down depending on the day, depending on what I've done, making me wonder if I should go back to a neurosurgeon and consult a neurosurgeon again and see if there are any surgical options. Meanwhile, my natural medicine practitioners, my PT, acupuncture, chiropractor, are all pretty certain that if I do some basic stuff, I'm going to be able to improve this. One of the things I have thought about is actively trying to lose weight. I'm not eating a lot of food, but I do tend to eat more sweets than I ought to. And if I actually actively lost some weight, I might feel better. I might and I might not, because I've read people report some people lose a bunch of weight and their spinal stenosis pain improves, and some don't. It makes sense, because when you're off balance, if you have a lot of abdominal fat, it's going to pull you forward and it's going to pull you off balance and put more strain on your spinal column. And the other thing is, on the one hand, when you're heavier, if you ride your bike, you're hauling around more weight, so you actually get stronger, but it's harder to work hard. So say if you're climbing a hill, it's much harder to climb a hill if you have extra weight. I do see men who weigh 20, 30 pounds more than me climb hills faster, but they probably have more muscle mass than I am, and they are probably able to get more consistent exercise because a lot of them are retired. Ugh. So, I mean, I am limited as to how much exercise I can get because I have to pair the exercise with running a business. And if I were to go riding my bike every day, you know, one of the things you have to do when you have Lyme disease, when you have chronic stuff, is you have to pace yourself. And so doing a lot of intense cardio around having, you know, 8, 9, 10 hour days of work doesn't really work. So I have to pace myself and only get certain amounts of cardio. What I tend to do is I get cardio on the days that I'm not doing patient care. If I could get up a little earlier, I could probably go for a walk, but I tend to sleep until the last possible minute, get in some PT exercises and or yoga, and then go to the office on patient care days. And on non-patient care days, I tend to do more. I tend to prioritize the bicycle, which is why, you know, when Tom at Crossroads said to me, you should go for more walks, I'm like, yeah, where am I going to put the walks? Because I'm prioritizing the bicycle. And so the answer would be to go walking on patient care days and go for a short walk, you know, 20 to 30 minutes before doing the PT exercises. It just involves getting up a little bit earlier. So there's all that. You know, and the other thing that now when I saw Travis at Crossroads, he suggested to me, you need to get in the water. So getting in the water would mean doing physical therapy exercises in the water. And my options are to go on YouTube and find some exercises that I could do in the water. And my water options, I have a friend's pool that I'm welcome to use during the season. And of course, I can go to Bicentennial Pond in Mansfield or any, you know, open body of water that you're allowed to go to. The most convenient is Bicentennial Pond in Mansfield. And I can always go to the Mansfield Community Center. I also can sign up for physical therapy. There is a practitioner, there are local practitioners who do aqua therapy and will take you to the Mansfield Community Center and do physical therapy with you. So that's another option that I have and something I haven't tried. Another thing I haven't done consistently, because it's not cheap, but it is very helpful and feels really good, which is to go do a float. And I wonder what would happen if I could afford to do regular floats a couple times a week. What would happen if that would help me a lot? That would be a very interesting thing. If I could do an hour float twice a week for a month, what would happen to my spinal stenosis? This is something I might want to talk to my buddy Angie about and see what happens. So that would be really cool if I could do that. And, you know, it's a great form of therapy. It's very relaxing. You're in a ton of Epsom salts and you have no gravity and you don't have to do anything. You don't have to do exercises. You're just floating and you're getting, you know, you're getting all the tension out of your muscles and you're making it so that your spinal segments can open up, which is what I really need. So I'm interested in that. Those are things that I'm working on. We'll keep you posted. Okay, so let's talk about, so now I have some interesting topics. I was perusing, trying to think about what I might want to talk about this week, and I came across an article that was titled The Luteal Uglies. I thought that was hilarious, and yet I related to it because I have a lot of patients who have issues with the luteal phase of their cycle. The luteal phase of your cycle is the part of your cycle after you ovulate, between ovulation and menstruation. Some women feel awful. And the main reason that I think that they feel awful is because they're estrogen dominant. And how do they get to be estrogen dominant? Well, let's look at the article and then we'll talk about my take on it. All right. So the luteal uglies. So this article was written by Ella Kipling for the BBC. So I believe that Ella Kipling is British, and this is a British article because it was in the BBC. So this person is wondering on TikTok, point of view, girls in their luteal phase, and she's wondering if she's the ugliest person that ever lived. So the video has 2.4 million views and hundreds of comments. And other women write, this is literally me. I'm angry at how accurate this is. There are thousands of videos like this one on social media lamenting the luteal uglies, the changes in appearance and mood that women say appear during the luteal phase of their menstrual cycle. During this phase, which occurs in the second half of a woman's cycle and ends when she gets her period, women experience a huge drop in estrogen. Yeah, they do, but they also experience a rise in progesterone. Your estrogen starts to drop at the second half of the luteal phase. It's really more that I think that it's more about estrogen dominance, that your estrogen definitely drops. Your estrogen and progesterone towards the very end, right before you get your period, they both drop. But I think what's really going on is people are progesterone insufficient. So we'll talk about that. So according to Louise Newsom, who's a women's hormone specialist, the change in hormone levels means women can expect a shift in their appearance, sleep, and mood during this time. Hormones affect our skin, collagen. So a lot of people find their skin becomes drier, complexion less bright, and they may have acne and spots. Newsom explains they might get bloating and breasts can change shape. And they might feel like their body is moving in slow motion. So some people feel like they're extremely bloated during the second half of their cycle. Skin feels dull and textured and just looks more tired in general. Chest feels heavier and sore. That's because when your estrogen falls in the days before your period and your progesterone rises, ramping up oil production in your skin, explains one doctor. During the hormonal shift, your body holds on to more fluids, meaning you may end up with a puffier face, general bloating, and tender, swollen breasts. Elena, who works in hospitality, is an actress in London, says she feels lethargic and completely unmotivated during the luteal phase. She feels like her brain is working in slow motion, tends to become clumsy and way more forgetful, and doesn't want to socialize as much. While women are starting to talk more about the impact of their cycles, a lot still don't know what to do about it. The women are genuinely suffering, and it's affecting their ability to work, function, socialize, and just exist. The response to women's concerns can be frustrating. Would you say to a man, "Oh, your testosterone is down, just don't go to the gym, have a duvet day"? It's unacceptable that women have to put up with it. Your relationship may also change during the luteal phase, which is something freelance journal Henrietta experiences. She finds herself wanting to get irritated with her wonderful partner, and there's an extremely high chance that if she hasn't had any coffee, hasn't eaten, that she's in her luteal phase. It also affects her friendships with her friends. She tends to overshare and regret it, or isolate and regret it. She can experience a despair and distress during the luteal phase, including feeling as though she's useless or having intense flashbacks to embarrassing or upsetting experiences. She also gets things like blurry vision, struggling to recall basic words, and feeling unfocused, which can be embarrassing to deal with at work. She wishes there was more awareness of the issue. There are still widespread misconceptions surrounding how and why hormones impact women's health and well-being. And then as soon as her period arrives, she feels better. So the doctor says that the luteal phase is not something women can just snap out of, and that women can often be wrongly made to feel that the symptoms are normal or that they're overly emotional, and people can dismiss these symptoms as just PMS. Why does it have to be just PMS? If it's PMS and you feel terrible and you want to do something about it, why not just take it seriously and do something about it? My patient comes in and says, "I have a purple spot. I don't want to have a purple spot." Unless there's really absolutely nothing to do about a very benign purple spot, I try to encourage them and figure out ways to help them with the purple spot. Whatever it is, we want to talk to you about what's going on. At the very least, we want to reassure you. So when people dismiss the symptoms as just PMS, it can be a big knock to your confidence, especially when you work with clients. And when you're self-employed, your calendar just can't stop because your hormones are changing. More education and discussion about menstrual cycles are needed. So there's so little education that women receive about fundamental aspects of how their bodies work. I find myself frequently with patients doing a review of how the menstrual cycle works, because people, so I did it recently. I did it with a mom and daughter last week. And I talked about how the menstrual cycle works from start to finish. And I said, "Did you ever learn that?" And they said, "We learned it, but not in that level of detail." And I don't remember that. People don't remember that sort of thing. And they don't understand how the hormones work, how ovulation works, how it works to get to your ovulation, what happens at ovulation, and then what happens in the second half of your cycle. You have the follicular phase in the beginning, and you have the luteal phase after ovulation, and then you have your premenstrual phase and your menstrual phase. People don't understand how that all works. So I was very fortunate that when I was probably 9 or 10 and starting to develop, my mom sat me down and she explained the whole thing to me and told me. And I remember having multiple conversations with her because, and every time I had a question, she would just answer it. And she encouraged me to answer, to ask any questions I wanted. And she kept explaining it over and over until I got it. So that was very helpful. So it wasn't a mystery to me. And then when I went to school, I got a really good review and a really good scientific explanation of how the whole thing worked. And so it was kind of drummed into me. And now I can repeat it as ad nauseum. So people want to know how to feel better during their luteal phase. There are thousands of comments. People wear baggy clothes, avoids the mirror, eat chocolate. Some people want to avoid their partners, or they just sit around and drink wine. And so those aren't great. That's probably not great advice, but it's kind of predictable. Understand that your luteal phase is predictable and temporary. Nutrition is key during the luteal phase. You want to stay hydrated, and staying hydrated can help to reduce your puffiness. Easing off salty foods, reducing alcohol intake, and keeping up movement can all help too. Steering clear of processed foods and alcohol will help you avoid increased inflammation, and see a health professional if you're particularly struggling during the luteal phase. If people don't get what they think is acceptable in the first, second, and third appointment, they should see someone else. These symptoms don't usually go away on their own. So that was very nice. Most of this article was describing the situation, and the bullet list has 5 points on it, and that's all. Now, these are good points. Understand that it's temporary. It's going to get better. Eat good. Don't eat too much salt because that'll make you puffier for some people. Stay away from processed foods and junk because you're more likely to have inflammation when your estrogen and progesterone are tanking, and get help. That, to me, that's not enough. You need more explanation than that. So the luteal uglies. So again, the luteal phase is the second half of your cycle. So what it means is that the follicular phase, you have a follicle that grows in your ovum, and then the follicle bursts open. So when the follicle is growing, the follicle releases estrogen, and your estrogen is gradually increasing during the first phase of the cycle, which is from day one to whenever your ovulation is, roughly day 14. It's different for different women. So your estrogen is growing, but you have very little progesterone at that point. And that part of your cycle, your estrogen dominant in the follicular phase, if you're going to get exercise, that's a good time to get strength training exercise, to strength building exercise, because you have your estrogen dominant. So estrogen is an anabolic hormone, which means that it grows tissue. So it's a good time to build muscle mass. So that's when you want to do your body weight exercises, your strengthening yoga, your PT exercises, weight training, any kind of weight training. You can do cardio if you want to, but focus more on weight training at that point in your cycle. You tend not to be so bloated, and so it's not as much of a concern to get that sweat on, although getting sweat on is helpful. Then you ovulate. What happens at ovulation is the one follicle, lots of follicles develop and they all kick out estrogen for you. But, generally one follicle only opens up, more than one can open up, and that's how you get multiple births. But, generally, ideally humans have one baby at a time. Nature will cause twins or multiple births, and people are more likely to have multiple births if they have in vitro fertilization, because they get many embryos implanted because they want to ensure that at least one of them survives. But what often happens is people who have IVF will have multiple births, and you know, more than one or two. So anyway, but in nature, ideally you want to have one baby at a time. So generally what happens is one follicle opens up, and that, so what happens is now you have the follicle that has opened half, and it splits in half. And so there's each human cell, given that you're a normal, you have a normal amount of chromosomes, and you can have different amounts of chromosomes. But let's just, for argument's sake, let's say we're talking about a person with 46 chromosomes. So the follicular cell splits undergoing meiosis, and half of it stays on the ovary and becomes a corpus luteum, which means a yellow body. And then it sits there and makes progesterone. And the other half becomes ovum, or future potential baby. So the part that's on your ovary, the corpus luteum, is sitting there making progesterone. And progesterone is anti-proliferative, which is why the second half of your cycle, you want to focus more on cardio, not so much on strength training. You can do strength training, but you'll probably find it easier to just to do mostly cardio and not focus as much on strength training in that half of your cycle, because progesterone is anti-proliferative. And the reason, one of the reasons it's anti-proliferative is nature wants us to have just one baby. So you make this progesterone. One of progesterone's job being anti-proliferative, anti-inflammatory, it turns around and says to all the other follicles that didn't open up, go back to sleep. We don't need you right now. So you don't ovulate again. If you're a cat, cats can have multiple ovulations, and they can get pregnant by more than one male cat, which is amazing. But humans, we are generally designed not to do that. So the progesterone turns around and says, go back to sleep, all of your other follicles. The other thing that it does is it ripens the uterine lining. So your uterine lining has been growing via estrogen during the first half of your cycle. Now the progesterone is going to go in there and make the uterine lining really nice and soft and thick and hospitable for implanting a baby. So that's progesterone's deal. And so progesterone, so now you have progesterone in this half of the cycle. Now, if you don't respond well to progesterone, or if you don't make adequate progesterone, you don't have adequate progesterone, you're going to feel yucky poo. So why do people have inadequate progesterone? Because progesterone has a two-step process to convert into cortisol. And if you are stressed out, you see, there's basically two ways of advancing the species. One is that a childbearing person has to have more of themselves. They have to replicate themselves. The other way is that person has to be safe and not get killed and die. So if you are stressed, you're under stress, your body doesn't know the difference of whether you have 9 million deadlines to meet, or taking the kids to soccer, or if you are running away from the bear or marauding invaders. Body only knows that you're under stress. So if it feels like you're under stress, it's going to make more cortisol. One of the places, so it makes cortisol from your adrenal glands, but the other thing it does is it takes progesterone, that progesterone's supposed to be there to tell your other follicles to go to sleep and also to ripen your uterine lining, takes that progesterone, converts it to cortisol. So now you're progesterone insufficient and you're estrogen dominant. And so the progesterone, if you're progesterone insufficient, now you have an inadequate uterine lining. You're less likely to implant, because if you're being chased by marauding invaders or, running away from a bear, we don't want you to conceive, because it's going to be a lot harder for you to run away from the bear. So nature was brilliant that way in coming up with that concept. So now you're low in progesterone, but you're estrogen dominant, and that makes you feel icky, because your estrogen keeps going up and up, and you don't have progesterone to back it up. So estrogen and progesterone balance each other out. Estrogen, as I said, is proliferative. Progesterone is anti-proliferative. So if you are lacking in estrogen, you're going to just keep getting bigger and bloaty and have sugar cravings and feel upset. Excess estrogen makes you cranky. Adequate progesterone calms you down, helps you sleep, and it just helps you feel better in general. So I think what the luteal uglies, what it's really about, is progesterone insufficiency. And people who have PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, I think there's profoundly lacking in progesterone. So what you want to do is offset that luteal phase dysfunction. That's what I think is going on. So luteal phase dysfunction, people are really progesterone insufficient. They're saying in this article that it's because of the increasing estrogen and progesterone. I don't know that that's the case. I think it's a functional imbalance, and that you're estrogen dominant and progesterone insufficient. So So how do we help with this? Well, the big thing, of course, is stress reduction. That is the number one thing that you want to do. Whether you eat good, whether you get exercise, whether you do this, that, or whatever's stressing you out, you want to calm that down and you want to do stress-reducing activities. So when you go the naturopath, what do we tell you? The first thing we do is we do talk to you about diet, just like the lady in the article said. We want to help you. You want to avoid most refined sugar and flour. Why? Because when you have refined sugar and flour, that taxes your liver, and you need your liver to break down and excrete the extra estrogen. The other thing is, if you have dysbiosis, your gut flora is off balance, you're going to have more anaerobic bacteria. And when you have anaerobic bacteria will deconjugate your estrogen. So when you're excreting estrogen, it goes into bile. It goes through your bloodstream, and both your liver and your kidneys filter it out. In your liver, estrogen gets conjugated. That means a hydroxyl group gets added to it, a little oxygen-hydrogen group gets added to it. That makes it water-soluble. Hormones are fat-soluble. When you make it water-soluble, now it can dissolve in bile, and you could poop it out. And if it gets reabsorbed, conjugated, then you could also pee it out. And so that's useful. So if you have too much estrogen, your body tries to regulate how much is in there. Now, if you have anaerobic bacteria in there, the bacteria may produce beta-glucuronidase, which is an enzyme that cleaves that hydroxyl group off the estrogen. So now you have deconjugated estrogen, otherwise known as estrogen. So what happens to the estrogen that's been deconjugated? Well, it's sitting there ready for reabsorption from your colon into your bloodstream. So now you're that's another contributor to estrogen dominance. So if you have dysbiosis, how do you get dysbiosis? By eating ICO, by not eating enough fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and, you know, plant-based foods, and eating too much starch and sugar. So you're going to get more anaerobic bacteria, and the anaerobic bacteria is going to deconjugate your estrogen. You're going to reabsorb it. Now you're estrogen dominant. So that's one of the reasons to watch your starch and sugar during your luteal phase. The other piece is estrogen. Remember, we said that estrogen is it's an anabolic hormone. It helps stuff to grow. One of the ways it does that is it knocks up insulin. So if you eat more starch and sugar, you're going to be more likely to be insulin resistant, or at least somewhat insulin resistant. You're not going to regulate your sugars as well. Who gets what? That's why there's a thing, gestational diabetes, because the increase in hormones, you're very anabolic at that point. You're growing a baby, and you're growing you so you can grow the baby. So if you're in an anabolic state and you overdo starches and sugars, you're more likely to get diabetes. That's why some women get diabetes during their gestation, and then it goes away once they give birth. And some women, they get the gestational diabetes and it stays with them after the birth, unfortunately. So there's a number of reasons to really watch your starch and sugar during the luteal phase. One of them is that if you're estrogen dominant, you're more likely to gain weight, and you need your liver to keep that extra estrogen conjugated so you can poop or pee it out, so you can excrete it better. And that way you're going to feel more balanced. Like I said, you want to not be estrogen dominant. You want to be estrogen and progesterone sufficient and balanced. Okay, so avoiding starch and sugar and processed foods. Processed foods are going to have chemicals in it. Again, they're going to tax the liver. You want that liver to be available for processing your hormones to keep them balanced. Do eat more cruciferous vegetables. Why cruciferous? So what's a cruciferous vegetable? Anything in the Brassicaceae family, that's the mustard family. That's going to be your cauliflower, broccoli sprouts, kale, collards, mustard greens, radishes. Those are all cruciferous vegetables. And those are cruciferous vegetables contain a compound called I3C. And I3C helps you to excrete extra estrogen. You also want to get exercise as tolerated. And during this phase, it's a good idea to focus on cardio exercise over weight training, although you can still do some of both. But if you're experiencing bloating, water retention, and irritability, moving circulation faster through your liver and kidneys and sweating is going to help with this, and also your mood. So what cardio should you get? What exercise should you get? The one you'll do. You do whatever you feel like. dance, dance in your living room, dance in your bedroom, go for walks inside your house, go for walks outside your house, get on a bicycle, go running, whatever cardio you like to do, row, it doesn't matter. One that's particularly good is swimming. If you can get into water, that's a great thing. Swimming is a great idea because of the hydrostatic pressure. So what happens is when you get, if you ever find you, if you're in the pool or the lake or wherever, long enough, you're going to be like, I really have to pee. And then you really, and you're more, so you're more likely to have to go to the bathroom to pee when you're in a body of water. And the reason, it's very simple. It's called immersion diuresis. I was noticing that that was happening to me while I was spending time in a pool. Why do I have to keep going to the bathroom? And then I looked it up. It wasn't just, you know, I was having a high kidney day. It was, there's a real thing called immersion diuresis. It's very simple. It's not rocket science. What it is that when you're in the water, you have hydrostatic pressure. And the hydrostatic pressure presses on your blood vessels and your capillaries and your interstitial spaces. So it presses on it and it gets the fluid out of the interstitial spaces. Interstitial means in between cells. Gets it back into circulation, and then your kidneys say, hey, that's too much fluid. We're going to send some out. That's it. So when you get yourself to urinate more, you're going to get rid of some of that bloating and puffiness. So getting in the water is a great idea. Getting in the water and moving, doing exercise, and even just swimming and doing laps is a great idea. Although if you happen to live near the ocean and you can stand in the ocean and jump waves, that's plenty. That's jumping waves is active enough to make a difference in how you feel. It's great for, it'll do that hydrostatic pressure thing, and it will also, it'll also make it so it's really good for your joints. And if you're achy and sore because you have bloating and inflammation, it's going to take care of that too. So the top cardio for this phase is swimming, and you're not always going to be able to get into a pool. So don't worry about it. Do the cardio that works for you, whatever that is. And remember, for exercise, you want to have something that you can do inside your home, something you can do outdoors, and something you can do out indoors, but not in your home. So you have those set situations set up so that anytime you go anywhere, you have some kind of exercise that you can do. So then you want to do stress-reducing activities. They're always a good idea. And which stress-reducing activity should you do? The one you'll do, the one you like, the one that's easy for you to do. When you do stress-reducing activities, you're going to lower your cortisol. So remember that the estrogen dominance is increasing your insulin resistance and your blood sugar, your glycemic status altogether. So when you lower cortisol, you're going to lower your glycemic status because cortisol's job is to run around your body, look for stuff to break down, turn into sugar, so you put it into your blood so you have energy to run away from the bear. So if you lower cortisol, you're going to have less of that effect. So stress reduction is the one you'll do. Yoga, meditation, taking naps, taking time in nature, deep breathing, using a vagal nerve stimulating device, whatever works for you, whatever you have accessible and available. So the luteal uglies are likely due to a relative estrogen dominance over progesterone, and that leads to bloating and irritability. Progesterone, so we already talked about this, progesterone can only be made two ways, ovulation and by the placenta. That's the thing, when you get pregnant, you make tons of progesterone. There's an easy two-step process to convert to cortisol, and if you're stressed, you experience progesterone steal. Your body converts progesterone to cortisol, so you wind up bloating and craving from that as well as excess estrogen. So stress reduction can help you hold on to more of your progesterone. So the other things we do, so in terms of supplements and things you can take, I offer chaste tree berry to start, which is an herb that bonds to progesterone receptors. It doesn't have progesterone in it, but it has constituents in it that stimulate estrogen or progesterone receptors, as does wild yam. So that's another herb that you can use. The nice thing about wild yam is that it's an antispasmodic. So if one of your deals is that you have, if you have cramping, then the wild yam is a good choice for that, as is cramp bark. But wild yam has the diastenin in it, which will bond to your and stimulate your progesterone receptors. It is not progesterone. It is a precursor to progesterone, but it does bond to progesterone receptors and lightly stimulate them. Some people take chasteberry and it really, really helps them. That I also tell people to do your cruciferous vegetables, and they contain I3C, which encourages the excretion of extra estrogen. Ground flax seeds and sesame seeds have also been studied to increase extra estrogen secretion. So if you put ground flax seeds over anything you would like it in, you know, you can make pudding out of it, you can put it over your salad or your soup or any food that you would like it in, you could mix it into a smoothie. Sesame seeds, if you like tahini, you can use that. Hummus has tahini in it, so that's going to help too. And tahini is just, you know, it's sesame butter, ground up sesame seeds. And they help you to excrete estrogen because they have lignans that do that for you. And if that's not enough, I may order supplemental DIM, which DIM is diindolylmethane, which is a metabolite of I3C, and also calcium deglucarate, which is a liver enzyme that removes extra estrogen. So I will give those supplements if somebody's really having a hard time. And then if need be, I will also recommend natural progesterone taken only during the luteal phase. The main cause of the luteal uglies is stress, and it's the progesterone steal. And if you try all of the basic natural medicine things and you just can't get there, one thing to do, like somebody comes in with PMDD and their life is really, really affected, one of the things I will go for is progesterone and have them take progesterone. And this is for menstruating women who are still in their reproductive life cycle. I'll have them take progesterone and we'll find a dose for them. Progesterone can be offered, it can be obtained over the counter at below a certain dose. I think it's 20 milligrams per dose. 20 milligrams and below per dose, you can get over the counter. Beyond that, you have to get it prescribed, and your physician can prescribe oral micronized progesterone and can also prescribe natural progesterone. They can prescribe compounded natural progesterone from a compounding pharmacy or from a pharmacy that offers compounded progesterone. They can also offer estradiol, and that you don't have to necessarily get that from a compounding pharmacy. And again, estrogen can be gotten below certain doses over the counter. But a woman who's still in her reproductive life, I will generally, unless we know that she's very low in estrogen, we don't usually give estrogen. We usually give progesterone because problem is that she's estrogen dominant. So you don't want to give more estrogen, and you're trying to get her to excrete her extra estrogen and have her progesterone status shine a little bit more. So you're usually not going to give estrogen to a woman who's still in her reproductive life, unless you know that you've tested her and you definitely know that she's estrogen insufficient. So that's all about the luteal uglies. This luteal uglies is for people who get PMS, premenstrual syndrome, dysphoric disorder, anybody who feels terrible the second half of their cycle. That is something you really can talk to a naturopathic physician or another kind of somebody who's a functional medicine person or somebody who really wants to do a holistic approach to the menstrual cycle. That's who's going to be able to help you. And if you go to a practitioner that can't spend a lot of time with you sorting it all out, you may be disappointed, which is what happens to a lot of women. That why can't my doctor help me with this? Because it's not simple. It's the fix for it is lifestyle stuff. And so who talks to you about lifestyle stuff? Naturopathic physicians and functional medicine people who can spend, doctors who care about it and can spend time with you. So that's who you want to see. All right, so let's go on to the next thing. We want to talk about how plant-based diets are good for diabetes prevention. So let's see about this. So there are people who are like all about everyone should eat plant-based. Everyone should eat meat-based. And where am I? I am, you guess, somewhere in the middle. I am with everybody should eat the diet that works for them, whatever that is. My diet is called the Fran diet. If your name is Joe, your diet is called the Joe diet. If her name is Alicia, her diet is the Alicia diet, whatever that is. And that's what I tell my patients, that what's the best diet for you? And they say plant-based. I said, no, the best diet for you is insert patient's name here, diet, whatever that is. And because everybody's different. You have biochemical individuality, you have blood type, you have body type, you have preferences, you have level of physical activity, you have health conditions. So you have to factor all those things in, and then you have to give advice tailored based on what that person, what works for that person based on who they are and what their body is doing. All right. So should you do plant-based or low-carb for diabetes prevention? So there's new research that says people are willing to make dietary changes to help with diabetes, but don't always understand which type of diet is best for diabetes. Research indicates that a plant-based diet is better for diabetes than a low-carb diet. Who knew? The best way to get started is with small changes like Meatless Mondays. Experts say it's not necessary to be vegan to reap the benefits. So you don't have to be vegan, but you can have some days where you don't eat meat. Unless you're a person who, if you don't have meat, you feel weak and tired and awful the next day. And that would not be me. You know, I do well. I did well when I was a vegetarian, but now I feel like with stress and with menopause, I need to eat some animal protein. But I don't need to eat huge amounts of animal protein. So I will eat tofu, I will eat beans, I will eat nuts and seeds, but I also eat some animal protein. And I'm not a big steak person, I'm not a big mammal person. I mostly don't eat mammals. The only way I can seem to eat mammals is if it's processed. So I get healthier processed mammalian protein in the form of meat sticks and jerky. Although jerky, I really prefer chicken or turkey jerky. My favorite kind of jerky is turkey jerky. I don't tend to get a lot of animal-based jerky. The meat sticks I can tolerate. So if I can get a pork meat stick or a beef meat stick, and that I can tolerate, really because it's processed, because my body is just not excited about digesting heavy meat. And it's okay with digesting poultry and fish, as long as it's not too much. And my body is very happy to digest vegetarian foods, vegetable sources of foods. So I do not get gas bloating from eating the big salad or eating the stir fry or eating a lot of beans. And not everybody is like that. And if that's you, I'm going to work with you on that. I'm not going to say you have to eat like me, because you shouldn't eat like me. You should eat like you. We just said that the best diet for you is the insert patient's name here diet. Okay. So this is very interesting. There's research that indicating that a plant-based diet is better for diabetes than a low-carb diet. I can't imagine that that's across the board, because what did I say last week? I never generalize. Thank you, Ron Coleman. Okay. Best way to get started is with small changes like Meatless Mondays, and it's not necessary to be vegan. So new research suggests that most Americans are open to making dietary changes if it could help prevent or control diabetes. There was a national poll by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine and Morning Consult that found that 65% of U.S. adults would consider adopting a low-fat, plant-based diet if their doctor recommended it. While many people know that eating more vegetables and fruits can lower diabetes risk, far fewer are aware that a low-fat, plant-based eating pattern, which is rich in fruits, vegetables, grains, and beans, can help prevent or even reverse the disease. And only very few respondents understood that. So people are open to diet change, but they don't know what to do. The poll surveyed over 2,000 U.S. adults aiming to assess awareness of dietary approaches to type 2 diabetes prevention and management, as well as openness to trying plant-based eating patterns. Respondents were asked about knowledge of the role of fruits, vegetables, and plant-based diets in reducing diabetes risk, and about their willingness to adopt such diets if recommended by their physicians. Among respondents whose healthcare providers had discussed type 2 diabetes with them, 57% knew that high vegetable intake can lower their risk, and 34% were aware that high fruit intake can also do this. However, only 21% recognized that a low-fat, plant-based diet could help prevent or improve type 2 diabetes. Does it have to really be low-fat? So when they say low-fat, are they saying low-saturated fat or low-animal fat? I guess. The poll also revealed a striking misconception. Half the adults who had spoken with their doctors about diabetes believed that a low-carb diet is the best approach. So plant-based diets help lower diabetes risk. So research that was cited by the Physicians Committee indicates that low-carb diets based on animal products are associated with an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. Who knew? Specifically, diets emphasizing animal protein and saturated and trans fats. Well, of course, well, the trans fats are the most concerning to me. They are linked to a 35% higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes, and that risk rose to 39% if the diet also minimized whole grain intake. So these low-carb diets. And so this study is suggesting low-carb diet is not where it's at. So the committee explained that eating less types of certain fats, especially from animal products, fried foods, and oils, allows insulin to work more effectively. So you want to eat the kinds of oils that support insulin. So that's going to be your omega-3s and your healthy omega-6s and your omega-9s. And not, they're suggesting not so much saturated fat. I don't know that that's true. If you're overdoing saturated fat, but again, everybody's different. If you're overdoing saturated fat, it could be an issue. But if you're eating, you know, eating seed oils, or if you're eating hydrogenated fats, you don't want those, because when you're having damaged fats, trans fats or seed oils or anything that's been, problem with seed oils is they're easily hydrogenated. They also contain too much linoleic acid, alpha-linolenic acid in it, which gets converted to your prostaglandin 2 series, which creates arachidonic acid, which is pro-inflammatory. So you want to have less of that. The thing is, when you get in adequate omega-3, omega-6, and omega-9, healthy omega-6, not arachidonic acid and linoleic acid, but things like gamma-linolenic acid, that's a great anti-inflammatory. Omega-3s and omega-9s are going to help you make healthy cell membranes. The healthier your cell membranes are, the better your nutrients can get in and out of cells. And you're going to be more insulin sensitive if you have good functioning cell membranes. So you want to eat the proper kind of fat. A super low fat diet is not going to be good for you. That we do see that people who are vegan who eat too little fat, they have emotional problems and they have emotional issues, and they also have nutritional issues. And the key is you need fats to build, you need the healthy, right kinds of fats to build your cell membranes, but because otherwise you will have more inflammation because you're not going to be able to get the nutrients in to reduce inflammation. So in type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance occurs when fat accumulates inside muscle and liver cells, which prevents glucose from moving out of the bloodstream and into cells where it's needed for energy. The fat buildup is a key driver of elevated blood sugar levels. So blood sugar spikes cause insulin surges and high insulin over time, which can make cells more insulin resistant and drive up high blood sugar even more. Decades of clinical research show that low-fat, plant-based diets do not restrict healthy carbohydrates. That don't restrict healthy carbohydrates can be beneficial for those with type 2 diabetes, but for those reasons outlined above, refined and processed carbs can actually have the opposite effect and should be avoided. So there was a 22-week study where almost 100 participants followed either a low-fat vegan without calorie or unprocessed carbohydrate limits, or the American Diabetes Association standard recommended diet, and results showed that 43% of the vegan group were able to reduce or discontinue their diabetes medication, compared with only 26% of the ADA group. Wow. The vegan group also experienced greater improvements in body weight, hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of blood sugar control, and LDL cholesterol. Another study by the Physicians Committee measured intracellular fat levels in liver and muscle cells, and after 16 weeks on a low-fat vegan diet, liver cell fat droplets dropped by 34.4% and muscle cell fat decreased by 10.4%. The reductions corresponded with improved insulin sensitivity, suggesting that the dietary approach can address the root cause of type 2 diabetes. So how can you get started with a plant-based diet? So the poll looked at what resources people would need to succeed with a plant-based diet. Nearly half of respondents said having access to an online recipe hub or regular guidance from a dietitian would be very helpful. To meet the need, the Physicians Committee offers the National Diabetes Program, which is a free online support group that provides education from doctors and dietitians on foods to focus on and avoid, meal ideas, grocery tips, dining out strategies, and answers to common nutrition questions. Additionally, the organization's Food for Life plant-based nutrition and cooking classes, developed by physicians and dietitians, are available nationwide to teach people how to prevent, improve, and in some cases, reverse type 2 diabetes through a diet rich in fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and beans. However, you don't have to join a support group, attend a class to get started on a plant-based diet, You can use, there are healthy lifestyle apps that you can use. A simple way to add more plant-based foods to your life is by trying your meatless Monday once a week and then gradually adding in more days. Search for vegetarian recipes that are easy to prepare and sound appealing to you and your family, people in your household. Meaning cooking ingredients and flavors you already know you enjoy. Vegetables do not have to be boring. They really don't. When we have stir fries, we have all kinds of seasoning on them. So we love our vegetables. And when we have soups, we have really flavorful soups. And when I have salad, Ron likes to put cranberries in his salad. He puts cheese in his. I put fake cheese in mine. Sometimes I put raw grass-fed cheese in mine, small amounts so I can tolerate it. Sometimes I will do the cranberry or goji berry thing. And I often will use nuts and seeds in my salads. And then we use olive oil and vinegar, and we put good olive oil on. Ron uses balsamic vinegar. I will sometimes use balsamic vinegar. I prefer to use I prefer to use apple cider vinegar, so I get organic apple cider vinegar, and sometimes I use plain, and sometimes I use the honey cayenne, and sometimes I will add hot honey to my salad. And then I'll put on other seasonings. I'll put an Italian seasoning, maybe a little bit of good quality salt or mushroom salt or black salt. And I also have Everything Bagel seasoning, which I put that on my salad too. And sometimes I'll put vegan Parmesan cheese on my salad. And so depending on what I feel like, I don't tend to use bottled salad dressing because if it's made with just olive oil, it tends to get hard in the refrigerator and doesn't keep well outside of the refrigerator. And if I get, a natural salad dressing that stays good in the refrigerator, it has seed oils in it. So I'm not interested in that. So I prefer to use oil and vinegar and then dress it up from there. Search for vegetarian recipes that sound appealing to you. You can also ease into a plant-based lifestyle by replacing one animal product at a time. You can try plant-based milks as a substitute for cow's milk if you want to. And you can also add more plants to your meals, vegetables, legumes, nuts, seeds. Gradually shift away from animal foods and make plants the star of the meal. That's what I often say, that you want your plants to be the star of the show. And my joke is that people eat huge slabs of meat, homeopathic vegetables, and huge vats of potatoes, and that's mostly not good for people. There are some people that might be good for it, but it's mostly not good for people. What you really want to do is eat vegetables, protein, and or vegetables, protein, and starches. So it's really something that you want to look at. For most people, eating more plants is a good idea. I can't say it's good for everyone because it probably isn't. And there are some people who do really well on the carnivore diet or with a high protein diet. I am just not one of them. And in my experience, so this is not as popular as it used to be, but there are different systems that group people into mostly carnivore, medium, and mostly vegetarian groups. So, for example, Mercola has it has a high carb, a medium carb, and a low carb group that he would put you into. And the blood type diet, if you're blood type A, you tend to do better leaning towards vegetarianism. If you're blood type B, you can eat certain kinds of meat and some dairy protein. If you're blood type O, which is most people, you do better with avoiding dairy and doing a bit of animal protein and doing plants, but less plants than if you were a blood type A. Blood type A can do better with legumes, whereas blood type O tends not to do that way. And then, you have the metabolic Metabolic Effect, which was my colleagues, Jade and Keone Tita. And they talked about sugar burners, fat burners, and sort of in-between burners, you know, moderate burners. So if you're a sugar burner, you're going to do much lower amounts of carbs than if you're a fat burner. And then there was one that was in the middle as well. So people tend to be grouped. Those are three large groups of people, and you can figure out which one is you and then work from that. If you get one of these plans where everybody should eat this way, so you talk about Dr. Gundry, for example. Dr. Gundry is nobody should eat lectins. And that's controversial. And he's saying nobody should eat cashews. Nobody should eat this. You should only eat tomatoes if they're peeled because of the lectins. I don't think that's useful. That now, if you are following the Gundry diet and you are doing great with it, mazel tov. Blessings on you. Keep doing it. But the thing is, my concern is when you start getting super specific about which vegetables you should eat, the problem is that most people are eating processed food, they're eating too much bread, they're not eating a lot of vegetables, they're eating basically animal protein and refined starch, and that's all they're eating. You want to get them over to eating vegetables, and don't give them restrictions as to which ones, that you want them to go ahead and figure out which ones they're going to like. And if they have broccoli and they get horrible gas, then of course don't eat the broccoli. But let them figure out what they like and what works for them and how to season them and how to get it healthfully for them. So I'm not a big fan of diet plans that restrict which fruits and vegetables you should eat. That I'm much happier to tell people, here, have fruits and vegetables, see how you feel when you eat them and figure out which ones you like and which ones agree with you. And see if you can cut back on the refined starch and the refined foods and all that stuff. And then ultimately you figure out when you start to listen to your own body, you start to figure out what foods work for you, whatever that looks like. All right. So very good. So that was exciting. Plant-based diets are good for diabetes prevention. That's the new latest. So you don't have to give up on brown rice or quinoa, apparently, that you can have some of that. I wouldn't have huge bowls of brown rice, but I would have a little brown rice with your big bowl of stir fry. And, you know, if you're going to get casual takeout, you can go to the Mexican place. That's the casual takeout place, and you're probably going to be okay. And the casual Mexican takeout places have options that it have more or less protein, more or less rice. You can build your bowls the way that you want them to look. And that's the kind of restaurant that you want to go to. And of course, if you have no clue, then think about getting a meal service, because meal services, you can design the foods you want and someone else can make it. And then once you see what it's like, you could maybe start to make it yourself. All right, so I'm going to let you go because that's enough for today. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS stores and WHUS.org. Thank you for listening.